For the chalice lighting this morning is Portia's famous speech from the Merchant of Venice. I'm going to read it without comment. I think it will be familiar to all of you. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself, and earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy.
We're glad that you've joined us today for our first annual celebration of Community Ministry Sunday. The Unitarian Universalist Society of Community Ministries has designated the first Sunday of February as a day to honor UU ministers and congregations who, through their work, apply our UU principles beyond our church walls. When I envision community ministry, I think of Sister Jordan Haddad, who's featured on the cover of our Order of Service. We're fortunate that following her accomplishments in Akron and Youngstown, Sister Jordan brought her tireless energy to Kent and Ravenna. Her legacy includes starting the first Salvation Army kettle campaign in this county, assisting local churches in establishing the county clothing center, and her founding of the Center of Hope in Ravenna and the Hot Meal Program in Kent. Our church was a partner in Sister Jordan's efforts, as the Hot Meal Program in Kent was initially started in the basement of this church, before moving to its present location at the Kent Social Services facility. Sister Jordan's selfless dedication to the poor and vulnerable left a lasting impression on those who were blessed to have known her. Let us be inspired to follow the benevolent and courageous footsteps of Sister Jordan as we take our faith into the wider world. Come, let us worship together.
Our wisdom words this morning are from Clarissa Pinkola Estes. Ours is not the task of fixing the entire world all at once, but of stretching out to mend the part of the world that is within our reach. Any small, calm thing that one soul can do to help another soul, to assist some portion of this poor, suffering world, will help immensely. I invite you now to close your eyes or to soften your gaze, to focus on your breath as we share silence together. Please join me in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life, spirit of love, be with us as we struggle through our personal struggles, our struggles with Mother Nature, as we watch those who struggle across the world. And as we struggle together as a faith community, learning how to be together in love, in truth, let us learn to live in love, to dwell in peace, in our hearts, in our community, and in the world. Amen.
The following is a poem by German playwright and poet Bertolt Brecht. It's only three stanzas, and the second and third stanzas are almost identical. I invite you to listen closely and notice the multiple meaning of the last stanzas as the different lines are emphasized. I hear that in New York, at the corner of 26th Street and Broadway, a man stands every evening during the winter months and gets beds for the homeless there by appealing to passers-by. It won't change the world. It won't improve relations among men. It will not shorten the age of exploitation. But a few men have a bed for the night. For the night, the wind is kept from them. The snow meant for them falls on the roadway.
Don't put down the book on reading this, man. A few people have a bed for the night. For a night, the wind is kept from them. The snow meant for them falls on the roadway. But it won't change the world. It won't improve relations among men. It will not shorten the age of exploitation.
I'm the manager at Kent Social Services, a facility that some people refer to as a soup kitchen. I hate that term. In fact, I was reluctant to allow our kitchen coordinator to prepare soup over the winter for fear of actualizing the stereotype. I agreed to help at KSS temporarily until a permanent replacement was hired. KSS is a program that I've always perceived as a Band-Aid program. It primarily provides emergency food assistance. I've always felt that it's much more important to support programs that promote self-sufficiency and social change rather than those that perpetuate dependence. Yet, as I listened to stories of struggle shared by people attending our hot meal program, I experienced a human connection and an emotional spark in my work unlike any other I had known. I asked if I could stay at KSS in a permanent capacity. Given my philosophical qualms about the nature of this type of work, what in the world compelled me to take a job that perpetuates a system of welfare that I loathe? The simple reason is that I have been touched by the pain and perseverance of the human condition, and it makes me feel alive. Many experiences have contributed to my sense of awakening, but one in particular stands out in my mind. It was the evening before Christmas Eve. I was working late at KSS, where we had just finished serving our Christmas dinner prior to our 3-day closing for the Christmas holiday weekend. Several people who had finished eating were lingering. A woman approached me and told me her friend needed help and asked if I could talk to him. I recognized her friend. He was a regular at our lunch program. I didn't know much about him other than the fact he was always very cheerful, friendly, and willing to help me with minor chores. But that night, he was uncharacteristically somber. She told me he was living in his van as he was homeless. She was worried that now that it was cold, he would freeze to death. He was angry. He explained his many efforts to find permanent work and obtain support services. For a variety of reasons, he was not eligible for help. I listened silently as he railed against his treatment by the system. As we discussed options, he informed me of what I already knew. Because of recent rule changes, you can't stay in the homeless shelter for more than 2 months. No exceptions. And once you've stayed there, you can't return for a year. He wasn't eligible to return until March, after the harshest period of the winter had passed. As he poured out his anger and his deep frustration with every attempt he had made to improve his situation, I realized that I couldn't help him. He knew that too. All he wanted from me at that moment was to find a way to figure out how he could get a sleeping bag. I was able to work that out, and he was grateful. There was little else I could do that night. Throughout the Christmas days of celebration that followed, thoughts of his situation pierced my holiday aura. I felt concerned for his well-being. I felt an undirected anger with the unfairness of life, and above all, a guilt pertaining to my life of privilege. I had come face to face with the harsh realities of life experienced by less fortunate individuals, a reality that I would rather have banished from my memory as I experienced the material gluttony of the Christmas season which my middle-class lifestyle affords me. I gained a better understanding of why some donors won't come into the KSS facility and instead meet me at the front door. It's painful to confront reality face to face. This conversation transformed me. My heart had been broken open by pain. In the past, I would have been overcome by a feeling of inadequacy when I couldn't solve every problem. But I refer to my pastoral training and the importance of being a listening presence. I'm further aided by words of community minister Reverend Emily Brault, a chaplain in a women's prison, whose words remind me, "I can't implant any magical coping skill or spiritual perspective that will make their lives easier. I wish I could. But really, they have to make the change, to face the pain, to figure out what it takes to get through this impossible life with any sense of hope or dignity or illusion of control. So what can I do? I witness their lives. I affirm their struggle. When I can, I try to offer different ways of seeing things, and I try to foster some sense of hope and light in the darkness, that maybe there's meaning to the chaos. I can provide nourishment for bodies through our services and nourishment for souls through listening and respect. Yes, it's charity work. It's a band-aid. But it's also a foundation for the hard work of the social activists. Besides providing direct service to the vulnerable, I can impact members of the community by promoting awareness of local poverty. Some people will simply never be able to be economically self-sufficient due to physical or mental limitations. The many people living among us on the edge deserve dignity as well as the essentials. By making presentations to community groups and sharing stories of real people struggling, I'm able to put a human face on the people that some would prefer to dehumanize or simply exclude from their awareness. It's easy to look down on someone who's unkempt in appearance, uses poor grammar, or someone who's mean, bitter, or cynical due to the harsh lessons of life. It's a challenge to be non-judgmental. But consciousness raising is possible, particularly for those willing to take advantage of the many volunteer opportunities at our facility and elsewhere. Here, people can, if they open their eyes, ears, and hearts, see humanity behind the worn faces and become acquainted with the pain experienced by members of our community. Building bridges of understanding and relationships with those facing injustices is a vital step in laying the foundation for successful social action. It's necessary to delve into charity work, get our hands dirty, and look people in the eye and acknowledge their pain, their hopes, and their ideas. It's true, we need to walk in the shoes of others. Doing so will render the hard work of social change more effective, as we'll be marching side by side, partnering with those seeking justice. As Reverend Parisa Parsa reminds us, this is the heart of community ministry, to open the doors to those who seek shelter and hope, and to look them in the eye and see them as precious, to love them with all the power and beauty of that divine spirit within them, to let that sacred spark ignite between us, and to create new possibilities for life. In a messed up world that would have us forget the divinity of ourselves and ignore it in others, we desperately need this reminder. Living our faith has two important aspects, doing and being. Both are necessary paths along the journey toward wholeness. Doing is the critically vital work of creating justice that Reverend Renee will present. Being is the self-work of developing compassion, humility, acceptance, unconditional love, forgiveness, and non-judgment. It is to grow a soul. Performing the work of charity and mercy is a path to being. Viewed in this way, service is not just a gift to others, it's also a gift to ourselves.
A brief history of the association. 350 years ago, small congregational churches dotted the New England landscape. In 1648, they came together and established a document called the Cambridge Platform, where they established not only the independence of congregational polity, but they also pledged their support to one another as congregations. About 200 years ago, those congregations and the ones that continued to grow from that movement split into a liberal and a conservative factions. The liberals were the Unitarians. The Unitarian churches needed a new way of being in relationship together, and there was a lot of controversy about how that would look. There was a small group of young guns who decided that they needed to have an institution, and thus the American Unitarian Association was born. It was an organization that provided Sunday school materials, that published magazines with writings of Unitarian ministers and others, and also they helped to establish the first seminary, which was in Meadville, Pennsylvania, and also the first community ministry in Boston with a gentleman named the Reverend Joe Tuckerman. Now, about 50 years ago, the Unitarians combined, or consolidated is the correct term, with the Universalists. And again, we had to reimagine how we were going to be in relationship with one another. And thus, the Unitarian Universalist Association was born. Now, it's interesting that the American Unitarian Association was modeled on nonprofits that were established about the same time as the Industrial Revolution. And I might argue that the Unitarian Universalist Association was modeled on sort of corporate America with sort of the GM, what's good for GM, it's good for the country. There was a little bit of directiveness that came out of Boston that a lot of congregations resented. And some of the program that came out was really good and some of it was not so good. Now today, we are really looking back to the roots of our Cambridge platform. What does it mean to be in relationship with one another as congregations? How do we support one another when we're in trouble? How do we encourage one another? How do we work together to make the world a just place? Faith without works is dead. It was this quote from the book of James in the Bible that summarized the mission of Sister Jordan Haddad, the founder of the Kent Hot Lunch Program. I had the privilege of serving as moderator of this congregation when Sister Jordan approached us about hosting a new program that would provide at least one hot meal a day for folks in the Kent community. I am still in awe of what a strong leader she was. and how she was able to get programs off the ground by sharing her vision and inviting people to be a part of that vision through both their hard work and their financial support. I remember her telling me about one of her patrons who would plant a field of sweet corn and donate the actual harvest to be used in several of Jordan's programs. That experience was formational for me and probably was a major factor for my call to ministry. First of all, seeing what her strong leadership could accomplish was inspirational. But I also learned quite a bit about how little I understood about organizations. When people come together in cooperation and creativity, some amazing things can happen. But at the same time, change also elicits anxiety in any group of humans, no matter how lofty the aspirations might be that are leading to the change. Hosting the Hot Lunch program required a lot of adaptation on the part of this congregation, and it wasn't a smooth experience. I made more mistakes than wise decisions. But I began to learn how we can work together to build the beloved community that we dream about. In our time for all ages earlier, we touched on different ways we can do ministry in the community. Some of them are easy fixes like the Band-Aids. But some of the problems that we face don't have simple solutions, like our poor polar bears. And it's tempting to look for easy solutions to such problems. The context in which we live is changing, sometimes at a frightening pace. We have to learn as we go. We have to learn how to learn together as a faith community. Our evangelical Christian brothers and sisters operate under a ministry commonly known as the Great Commission. Their mission work, though it may be embodied in soup kitchens and foreign schools, is to spread the teachings in the Christian scriptures and to baptize new believers into the Christian community. I like to think of Unitarian Universalism as having a living commission. We do not offer a fixed doctrine based on a 2,000-year-old text. Instead, our mission is to offer a way of being in the world that encourages wholeness, encourages creativity, and celebrates diversity. How this has manifested has changed in the course of our own history. Because of our liberal stance of being in the world instead of set apart from it, we've been influenced by our context. Our living tradition gives us permission, in fact, requires us that we continually question our assumptions and be willing to change when needed. We do this as congregations, and from what I am seeing, we are also trying to do this as a denomination. My community ministry, as UUA staff, is in service to Unitarian Universalism as a whole, not just to the folks who reside at 25 Beacon Street in Boston. I am part of an experiment where four districts and the folks in Boston are finding better ways to serve congregations. Our district staff, like the Reverend Joan Van Biesler, spend a lot of their time helping churches who are in transition or crisis. The folks in Boston are a little bit removed from congregational life, and sometimes the programming that they develop misses the mark. My job as regional staff is to help congregations be better at what they do and to learn from one another's successes and failings. My particular ministry is on leadership development. Liberal religion has always held up the ideal of shared ministry, that everyone in the pews is called. Luther called it the priesthood of all believers. UU theologian James Luther Adam called it the prophethood of all believers. In theory, we believe in an empowered laity. We have congregations full of people who have both compassion for others and a passion to serve. My community ministry is to help us to develop congregations of potential into congregations full of Sister Jordans, effective leaders who have the vision and the leadership capacity to channel those passions and to do the work that is needed to mend our broken world. This morning, I thought I would give you a little taste of the kinds of leadership we are trying to develop in our congregations and what this can do for us. One helpful model was developed by Ron Heifetz from the Harvard Kennedy School of Business that's called adaptive leadership. Heifetz divides problems into two different kinds. The first are technical problems. These are the kind of problems that have a clear solution. For example, if the brakes on your car are broken, you go and get them fixed. If you have a new cell phone, you learn how it works. Here at church, if we start running out of coffee, we just make more cups of coffee for coffee hour. The problem is clear and the solution is clear, so that's a technical problem. But other kinds of challenges don't seem to respond to these technical solutions. These are the kinds of problems that seem to come up over and over again. Needing to lose a few pounds, trying to get out of debt, often fall into this category. And on a bigger social scale, responding to issues of racism or dealing with climate change also come up over and over again and don't have easy or clear solutions. In free faith communities like this one, finding ways to work together to solve these problems without compromising our individuality is also an added challenge. Heifetz calls these kinds of challenges adaptive challenges. There may be some technical aspects of the challenge, but in order to really address these kinds of situations, we need to approach them in a totally different way. First, we need to realize that identifying the problem and proposing solutions require a posture of curiosity and a commitment to experimenting and learning as we go, which includes the possibility and probability of making mistakes. There is no single truth that is waiting to be discovered, but there are possibilities that are waiting to be explored. The other aspect of adaptive challenges is that the stakeholders, the people directly affected by the challenge, also need to do part of the work of addressing the problem. Much of this is internal work, working on one's own priorities, beliefs, habits, loyalties, and commitments. We as a congregation are facing such adaptive challenges. When I first started attending here, we were known as the funky little rundown church with the ex-hippies. Shower curtains served as doors in the women's bathroom. Ivy covered our building and the front door was bricked closed. We had a minister who had been subsidized by an extension grant from the UUA in Boston. But in spite of that help, we were always in a financial crunch and had a hard time making payroll, let alone other responsibilities like paying our dues to the UUA. Today, our building is well maintained, and our bathrooms rival those at classy restaurants. Our staff is compensated on time and at fair levels, and we are working toward paying our fair share of dues again. And we are bursting at the seams with our growth and have some decisions to make about how to address that growth. Decisions that will require each one of us to change in some way. Another adaptive challenge is discerning how we should live our mission in the world of creating peace and justice. How are we willing to change as we work for change in the world? How do we stay in right relationship with those that we serve? How do we hold ourselves accountable to each other and to our highest ideals? That same work that is internal to each one of us is also work that we must do together, to work on our shared priorities, our shared beliefs, our shared habits, loyalties, and commitments. I sometimes think that classifying this kind of work under leadership is somewhat misleading. I see it as part of our commitment as a denomination to integrity and wholeness. Every one of us can get to understand our commitments and pay attention to the changing context in which we live. Every one of us can approach the world around us in the spirit of curiosity and experimentation. And when we truly live in covenanted relationship, every one of us can develop the integrity to both trust and be trusted. What I imagine is an interconnected network of Unitarian Universalist congregations filled with this kind of capacity for both leadership and integrity. That's where I find hope in this changing world. People like you and me, willing to be open to change. Amen, and blessed be. Our benediction is from Eric Walker Wickstrom. If you are who you were, and the person next to you is who she or he was, if none of us has changed since the day we came in here, we have failed. The purpose of this community, of any church, temple, zendo, mosque, is to help its people grow. We do this through encounters with the unknown, in ourselves, in one another, in the other, whoever that might be for us, however hard that might be, because these encounters have many gifts to offer. So may you go forth from here this morning, not who you were, but who you could be. So may we all. Amen.